And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest today is Tova Mervis. Her two previous novels, The Lady's Auxiliary and The Outside World, were published to much critical acclaim. Her new novel, the first in 10 years, is called Visible City, and it's available from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Visible City is the story of a couple of families in Manhattan, plus some of their neighbors, and let's start off with Nina and Jeremy. They've got two very young children. Both Nina and Jeremy are attorneys, but Nina isn't negotiating with her clients as the book opens.
Right. Negotiating with a two-year-old can be far harder, I guess, than negotiating with some clients. And I was interested in a character who had professional training, but like many women, chooses to stay home or feels the need to stay home when she has young children. And for me, a lot of the interest in writing Visible City was thinking about modern motherhood. And I feel like there's so much about how one is supposed to be as a mother. There's so many rule books and manuals and advice books that sometimes you don't even know which way to turn. Every act you're supposed to do, someone else will tell you you're not supposed to do. And so for Nina, I wanted to think about what happens when she is home and what happens to her ambition or her other interests. And I wanted to write about life with small children. I wrote a lot of the book while my own children were young and would have moments where I would be caught in the chaos where, you know, five things were happening at once, all of which needed immediate attention. And I think one of the ways that I stayed sane and all of that was by thinking, I'm going to write about this one day.
And, of course, one kid, difficult, the next kid exponentially, and then the next kid beyond exponential.
Exactly. Each kid has his or her own personality and then plays off the other personalities you have at play. So I have three kids. Three can feel like a zoo sometimes.
And of course, I mean, they're never going to be coordinated when it comes to time, and it's just difficult to get everyone on a schedule.
Right. No, they're somehow programmed not to be on a schedule.
And so there's Jeremy, who's the husband, and he hasn't quit the attorney game, kind of how Nina has. He's on that hamster wheel, and he's chasing a partnership, and he's working probably, what, about 100 hours a week?
Yeah. I mean, I was interested in also in about work and how so much of our lives is poured into jobs. And I think for those of us who like what we do, that is a very lucky place to be, but it's probably not the norm. And in creating the character of Jeremy, I wanted to write about someone who did what he was felt like he was supposed to do. He sort of followed this sort of path towards success of what everyone is supposed to do. And he went to a good school and went to law school and then got a good job at a law firm. And yet that question of, well, what makes happiness? Where does happiness come into the equation? And for him, there was always the feeling that eventually he would have time to think about that. Right now, there was no time to think about anything but the task at hand. And so I wanted to think about, well, what is the effect for family life? And what are the necessities of work in so many places, the financial necessities? And yet, at the same time, what is the impact of that kind of work expectation in a world or a corporate world that expects people to be always available? And Jeremy is a character who I enjoyed writing. I enjoyed thinking about, well, how do people carve out small spaces for themselves where they feel like they can be themselves, or places inside this vast sense of demands all the time where they can have one small thing that they love for themselves alone? So Jeremy becomes interested in, for a variety of reasons, in the city in Manhattan where he lives and exploring these underground sealed off spaces in the New York City subway station. You know, it always fascinates me. There are these ghost stations that are no longer in use but are still there. And Jeremy becomes interested in learning about these closed off spaces. And I was interested how I think for all of us, we carry inside ourselves these closed off spaces. I think we all have our ghost subway stations where we seal away pieces of ourselves and parts of ourselves that we feel like can't be exposed to the light of day.
And it was really interesting with Jeremy because here he is working 100 hours a week. And then when he does have some free time, instead of going home with his family, he's going out to explore. And so, in essence, he's, in a miniature way, abandoned his family to visit some place that has been abandoned.
Right. It's interesting, right? This notion of what does it mean to abandon? What are the places that we have to leave or that we seek out? And, you know, I think that's a really interesting idea of what is the appeal of an abandoned space? I think that there's something, this urge to be somewhere that no one else has been, or to uncover something that people have not seen. And I thought about, you know, the notion that he's not home with his family. This idea of free time being such a valuable commodity, this sense, certainly in a city in Manhattan, this constant sense of a rat race. I felt like the most valuable commodity is a spare minute, and thought about how I think this pull, that it's not just a pull for mothers, but fathers as well, where you're pulled in so many directions at once and wanting to be there for the people you love. And yet, when is there time to be there for yourself? And I think that I don't feel like there are any good, clear answers to that. And I think one of the things I love about being a novelist is that I don't have to provide, you know, the answer. There's no prescription for, you know, work balance, work-life balance. Is there a clear answer? I don't know what it is, but engaging in the question of how do people make time in their day for the things they really love.
And of course, it would be great if both Nina and Jeremy were able to do what they love and to both be involved with the family, both work as a career and something that they like a lot. But, you know, of course, you can see Nina's chafing at being stuck with children all day long and not having adult relationships to sustain her. But then also Jeremy to come home and see his wife do a good job with the kids. I mean, she does have her own kind of neuroses about what she's doing to her children, as all okay. parents do. But then to have him come in just from time to time and kind of be this superfluous part of the equation.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. Like, life with children takes on its own pace and its own language. And I think there are times when you're home with the kids where you feel like you're so ensconced in their world and sort of what's happened that day and in their imaginary world and in their creative world. Sometimes I feel like, you know, having been home with my kids for so many years and working part-time or always trying to carve out spaces to write, but certainly living that life at home with kids also, that feeling that you almost forget there's an adult world. I remember sitting around in like a gymboree class with a two-year-old and all the kids had wandered off, and I looked around and I was sitting in a circle of other mothers my age, and we were all singing the songs and there were no children in sight. And you just feel like, what happened to my grown-up world? Where did it go? And I think that's one of the tensions of motherhood. And, you know, again, I don't think there's an answer. People, you know, some people like to sort of grandstand about women should do this or mothers should do that. And I just disagree with that idea that there's one answer for any one parent. But I think that to articulate that question or that struggle, that urge to have your own identity and your own career, and yet that urge to be there with your children. And I think that there's no good answer, which is why we're constantly asking that question again and again.
If there were one answer to the world,
wouldn't it be nice?
We would have already found it.
Right. Some people like to think there is, but I don't know. I don't think
so. That's just the problem of being human right there.
Right. That is the novelist's domain. That is, you know, exactly the problem of being human. It's impossible to answer in one way. And I think what I love about fiction is that fiction is a place to just untangle all the problems of being human. That sense of the problem of two people together, where the way I see something is not the way you see it, and what I want might not be what you want. And I think Invisible City, that was something that was really fascinating to me, that you might view one character's action as a betrayal and another character might view it as an act of, you know, an urge for freedom. And there's no one solution for it, but I think it's this impossibility of life among other people, that people want different things.
And in reading along the way, you see characters sometimes behave in a way that you get frustrated with mm-hmm. or even disagree heartily mm-hmm. with, but even then I couldn't say you're a bad person.
Right. You know, people talk about, like, you know, what is an unlikable character? What makes a bad person? I feel like my job as a novelist, and I hope my job as a person, is to enter into someone else's experience. And I think fiction is a place where we learn empathy. But for me as a writer, it's the thing I try to do all day with my characters. And I try or hope it can sometimes spill over into life where, you know, when we want to label someone a bad person or unlikable, we're forgetting the fact that people live private struggles inside their own lives all the time. And sometimes we're deliberately fooled by people's facades. We sort of put on our game faces and we, you know, talk about how everything is perfect. You know, my children are 100% perfect and I'm happy all the time. And I don't know about you, but my life is perfect. And that lie we tell each other, it's like this assault we do to one another to put forth this idealized notion. And I think that when you recognize that everyone is going through their own struggle and everything is that things are infinitely complicated, and even actions we might look at and want to say that's wrong or that's bad, I think that you can also have an experience of saying, well, what is that about? What is going on for that person? Or in a book, what is that about for this character? And I feel like that is what fiction teaches us more than any other kind of writing.
That need and kind of desire to be pleasant and put forward a positive image is, you know, kind of a social lubricant, because you don't have time to sit down with everybody and say, okay, my life is screwed up in X, Y, and Z ways.
It's like, I just wanted you to say you're fine. I wasn't interested.
We would never get anywhere if that way. But then also, there comes the overcorrection in trying to live a frictionless existence. And you can see that through the character Wendy in the book, and that she believes that there shouldn't be any hiccups in life, and that she values complete lack of friction, and there's no purchase into putting in roots without friction and digging deeper.
Right. I mean, wouldn't we all like that life where we sort of sail through? And I think maybe growing up, some of us believe that if we just are good, if we follow the path, we will have life will just unfold as it's supposed to. And then there's those rude awakenings of moments of realizing it's not quite looking the way I had planned. And in writing about Wendy, I wanted to write about a mother who so badly wants it to be perfect. And I feel that my own self as a young mother, wanting so badly to do it right, to give my kids everything, to be there always, to always be finger painting and baking cookies and singing songs and to never get angry and to never be unhappy. And that wish, I mean, I feel that wish so much, and yet it's an impossible wish and maybe not even a necessary one for kids, right? I mean, they don't have to grow up viewing the world in these sort of pristine terms. But with Wendy, I wanted to write about a mother who holds herself to that standard and what that does to someone, to feel like if she yells at her kids, then she's an awful mother, and who, over the course of the book, I think has to learn how to create that space to say, okay, I screamed at you, let's all move on. We can all survive that moment. But I also was interested in her as a character because my main character, Nina, feels her own imperfection as a mother, but she looks to Wendy as this sort of perfect, idealized figure. And I was interested how I think in motherhood and also in other places in life, we appoint other people as our judges or as our heroes, and we love them and we also hate them. I think we hate them with a passion when we feel like they're always doing it right and I'm not. And I wanted to think about how when we get to know those people, that idealized notion falls away very quickly.
But that love and judgment character when we first start off are our parents.
Exactly.
And there's at one point in the book where you talk about her kids finally understood that their mother had limits, so they knew when to back off at that point.
Right. There's that urge, you know, do everything for the kids. I remember thinking, I'm not doing anything wrong as a mother. I'm giving my kids every single thing they want. And that carries its own mistakes, of course. And that sense of, you know, when do kids get to see, you know, maybe we don't get to see it until we're adults, but seeing that our parents are people just like we are, and they're imperfect and they're struggling and they do some things right and they do other things wrong. And I think now that my kids are a little older, I have a 15-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 6-year-old. One of the things I've learned through my 15 years of motherhood is that it is an imperfect process, and that's okay. That I think there's a lot of freedom in recognizing imperfection.
There was one line in the book about meeting 1,000 needs but not achieving anything.
Right.
And it's been a while since your last book.
Yes, I've met a million needs.
So I'm not going to say that there are any like real world behavioral paradigms in the book, but of course there's some emotional truth, I'm sure, that of yours in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the book took 10 years to write, which, you know, I cannot believe. When I started writing it soon after moving from Manhattan to the Boston suburbs and planning to write my third novel about Memphis as well. I really want to write sort of a long-spanning Southern Jewish novel and look at a family story that's told in my own family and how it gets passed down through different generations. And that was the book I was sort of – my second book had just come out, and I was ready to really dig in. I had been writing it for a little while and doing some research and thinking about it. But I was so overcome with missing Manhattan and missing – most of all, the sense of walking in the city, that feeling that at any moment something unexpected could happen. And so I decided I was going to take a short detour and write a short little New York novel, and then I'd go back to my Memphis book. And I don't think I could have at all foreseen it would take me 10 years. And part of it is kids, part of it is life with children, and just the sense, the constant sense of children's needs and wanting to fill them, and that difficulty of creating time to write. In an early version of the book, I had sent the first chapter to someone to read, in which Nina, the young mother, is sort of overcome with the different needs of her kids. And the person called me back around 5 o'clock in the evening, right as I was struggling with 3 children. I had a new baby and 2 boys who were fighting and throwing things. And she said, you know, I just feel like the mother is a little too frazzled. Could you tone it down a little bit? And I think I had 3 children on top of me as she said that. And I was like, okay, I guess I could tone it down, but I felt like this is the reality. It was certainly the life I was living of being in the thick of it with children. And so that's one reason it took so long. But I wanted to convey that feeling of being besieged by children's needs and wanting to fill them. And yet at the same time, that sense that can you ever fill every need? You know, that, you know, you clean up one spot and it's messed up before you turn around, or that endless cycle really of needs.
At one point, a mother's talking about how the kids aren't self-reliant enough and they need to give their kids self-reliance.
Right. We have to give them everything. Yes. That feeling of I will give you everything, even the thing that I'm not supposed to give you.
Now, you talked about how we have the ability to see other people's facades and kind of project our needs and desires on them. And Nina is doing that with a couple that live in a building across the way, and that's Leona and Claudia. Nina's a little bit unhealthily obsessed with this couple.
She is obsessed with them. I mean, they become her entertainment. And I think one of the interesting things about living in a city is that we can watch people the way we watch our television sets. We almost forget that they're actual people. There's this anonymous intimacy to city living where we look out our window and people's lives are unfolding, just as they might be looking out their window watching our lives unfolding. And so she watches them out of her own loneliness and her own boredom. But this couple across the way, I think she becomes so fascinated by them because they come to represent something she longs for. And I think anytime we're fascinated by other people's lives or we become immensely curious about something a friend is doing or a piece of gossip we hear about someone, I think it really tells us something about what we're looking for in our own lives. And so for Nina, at first she sees contentment. She sees a quiet, old, middle-aged couple reading on the couch, and she brings her own wish to it, to see this sense of marital contentment she doesn't have. And yet when we get to know people, we find that the story is a little different. And so she sees that they're not the way she imagines them to be. But I'm always interested in the way we watch other people. And in many ways, I think being a novelist is like being a voyeur, where we watch people. And as a novelist, you're always sort of gathering bits and pieces of other people's lives and then supplying imagination and creating a story out of those real life pieces you've taken. And I was interested in how watching people, you know, it's not just that you're seeing someone, but you are becoming part of the story as well. And Invisible City, Nina ends up getting to know them in lots of different ways and becomes entangled in their marriage and in their life. But I was interested in what happens when you don't just watch, but you step into life, and when people leave the boxes of their windows and actually emerge into the street and become involved with each other.
Talk about multiple kids being complicated. You start adding in other adults, and right. Gee whiz.
Right. I feel like with a novel, sometimes I felt like I have all these characters. I cannot control any of you. What am I going to do with all of you today?
And you spoke about windows, and I spoke with Karen Russell last year, and she goes, who doesn't love a good window for a metaphor?
Exactly. Right. Windows are right. They're so ripe for a metaphor. I mean, it's about looking out and being visible ourselves, and it's the way through which we see a world. And I've always been fascinated with windows. I love pictures of things through windows. I think windows convey longing and loneliness and isolation and yet possibility. And I was also interested in Invisible City and writing about stained glass windows. I feel like they're this real anomaly of windows where we can't see through them, and they're an art form. And I became really fascinated with how beautiful they are when light is streaming through them. I feel like a dark stained glass window sort of seems fairly uninteresting, but all of a sudden in the right light, they're gorgeous. You just feel the sense of all these tiny pieces assembled together to make this whole. And so that worked its way into Visible City as well, sort of looking at a different kind of window.
And of course, one of the characters talks about how when the light shifts, the sun shifts in the sky, mm-hmm. it changes the appearance mm-hmm. of the window and the light that's coming through it. And of course, throughout the course of the book, we see the characters through these different positions of the sun.
Right. I feel like stained glass gave me a chance to play with my themes in a different way. And stained glass requires light, you know, on it, light streaming through it in order to be seen. And of course, people do as well. We need attention and light to show our full selves. And so I thought about how what happens when there is not sufficient light in a relationship, and also about change. I mean, I think the book really is interested in asking the question in different contexts of when can we make change? When is there the need to hold on to the way things have always been, to stay in something that feels comfortable and stable? And yet what happens when that urge meets up with the desire for something new or the need to make a change? And change, of course, is terrifying. Those moments when you feel like you're jumping off a skyscraper, and even if they feel necessary, they are awful in so many ways. And that sense of, I don't know where I will land. And I think Invisible City, a lot of the characters are on those edges. And I felt like one of the things I had to do over the years of writing them was be willing to push them off those edges, be willing to make them jump and to say, I don't know what I'll find on the other end. And so stained glass was a way to think about light shifting, and it changes something that seems fixed. And I guess, of course, a city is always changing as well. The city that I left 10 years ago looks very different than it does now, but I had a version of it fixed in my mind that I would visit every day while I was writing it. But I was really interested in Invisible City, in writing about the tensions about change in the physical space of a city, not just in characters' emotional lives, but people who want to preserve buildings. And there's a whole thread about historical preservation And when do we say these buildings are important, we're going to keep this building or this neighborhood the way it is, versus the idea that there's always change and we have to make way for something new and for what comes next. And so some of the characters become involved in that fight in the book as another way of thinking about change.
Yeah, there's that big controversy with Spike Lee and a journalist up in New York right now about the changing face of Brooklyn. Mm. Spike Lee saying it's not like it was like Brooklyn was in the 80s. Well, Brooklyn in the 80s wasn't like it was in the 50s,
right,
or then in the 20s.
Exactly. I mean, the cities are always in flux. Every place is changing. But yet, when do we say we want to preserve some piece of it, or when do we say it's impossible to preserve that the city we're trying to preserve itself was a change from what came before?
Now, let's stretch the stained glass window metaphor mm-hmm. to maybe its breaking point.
Sure.
The lead lines mm-hmm. that hold the pieces of glass together. I mean, they surround and kind of define the piece, but they do separate it from the next piece. But right. without those lines, they wouldn't be coherent and form a picture.
Right. I mean, you could say, is it the structure of our lives,
yeah.
right? That we need something to hold it together, that you can't, that the stained glass is impossible without those lines of holding them in place. And also, it's what allows us to differentiate, right? Otherwise, how would we have a red panel and a green panel or a different piece of glass? And so I think that's the tension between looseness and tightness in so many ways, and between structure and disorder. And I think we all feel that in our lives in so many places. Sometimes we come up against those hard spots and want to break through them. And yet those places do give us definition. And I think stained glass is fascinating to me because it's an assemblage of so many different textures and colors. And when you get really up close to one, you see all the imperfection of glass. And one of the things I was really interested in, the novel centers around John Lafarge, a stained glass artist, who loved the imperfect pieces of glass. He purposely chose pieces of glass that were dappled or cracked or were not sort of pristine surfaces. And I love the idea that beauty comes from imperfection, that the more perfect facades of glass were not the ones he was interested in, but that sense of dappled, messy life, I think, is where so much beauty comes from.
He didn't want a visual frictionlessness.
No. Right. For him, that would be uninteresting. Smooth surfaces were boring. They weren't real or true. You know, they weren't as interesting as glass that had been through something, that had been fractured in some way.
And of course, Lafarge's work is Claudia's area mm-hmm. of interest. She is an art history scholar, and she doesn't currently have a teaching assignment. And so she's obsessed with a potentially unknown Lafarge window.
Right. She becomes convinced for a variety of reasons that there's one last great work of Lafarge stained glass window that was lost somewhere in the city. And I sort of got that idea from an academic article I'd read about John Lafarge that posited that idea in a footnote. And the idea of a lost work of art is fascinating. I think a lot of writers have written about that idea. But I think it's the notion that there's something beautiful in the world that we don't know about, and that quest to find it, I think, is also, of course, about a quest in our own lives to uncover something beautiful or to be seen in a way we're no longer seen, or to find something in other people that we thought was sealed away. And so Claudia has this idea that this stained glass window will provide some answer for her own life. And I think also just the urge to see something. I think we walk past so many things without actually seeing them. But this sense of the pleasure in looking at something beautiful, and especially when it takes us by surprise, when we don't expect to catch sight of something. And walking in Manhattan, I always felt that way. You know, you're not supposed to look up at buildings, not supposed to look people in the eye, all these things you're not supposed to look at. Walk fast, don't look from side to side. But if you stop, if you sort of play tourist for a minute in a city you know well, so many of the buildings are gorgeous. There was a building near where I used to live that had these gargoyles carved on the facade. And I must have walked past it 100 times without even noticing them. And then had a moment where I looked and I was like, how could I have passed this every single day and never noticed it? And kids, I think, are better at noticing those details. My children would see things that I would walk right past without even recognizing the beauty of them.
But also, I feel a disappointment with contemporary architecture in that, I guess probably going back to the brutalist styles, that we just don't have that kind of ornate right. decoration that adds a bit of interest to something.
Right. We're sort of anti-embellishment. We're anti this notion of decoration, whereas like in the early 1900s, that style in Manhattan, these pre-war buildings are gorgeous, filled with detail and filled with ornate style and carving. And I think that there's an urge to uncover that in the book, to recover that sense of the past. And one of the tensions in the book is about a new apartment building being built, which is going to be all mirrored facade, all just windows. And that longing for a different style, I think, that sense of artistry in a different way than sort of the sleek, clean facade that seems to be the prevalent style now.
Yeah, it's just that Corbusier, the machine for living,
right. mm-hmm.
and just that it's disappointing. It doesn't represent who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Claudia's husband, his name is Leon, and he's a therapist. So we got a therapist in New York City and a novel. Let me guess, he's not well adjusted.
Right. Is anyone? Right. He's right. I can't remember how I decided he was going to be a therapist. I think I just knew right away that this character is a therapist. It just seemed clear. But I guess I'm always interested in the way that where people reveal their secrets. And, you know, as I was saying, in public, I think we hide them away. And I feel like, well, here, Nina's so hungry to know the truths about other people's lives and what really goes on. And so I feel like, well, here's a character who has access to that, and which is why I think it became interesting for me to have sort of to play off that possibility in this character.
And to give him a very much a New York twist, he loves sitting in his car waiting to move it for the street cleaning day.
Right. Manhattan has these very strict rules about your car and where you can park it. And, of course, space is such a huge commodity. And so you can park on a side of the street, but only until Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. And then you have to move it to the other side. And so people sort of stake out their parking spots. And I never had a car living in New York City, but would watch people who sat in their car for 2 hours till the street cleaners went by. And then they would move to secure the best possible spot. And I thought a lot about how in New York, there's so little space. I mean, I felt like any square inch was such a valuable commodity. A closet could be an office. I mean, I would have happily worked in my closet if I could have, you know, that this feeling of there's no empty space and everything is so congested and so tight. And so a car becomes another possible space. And so for Leon, he moves his car for practical reasons, but that really becomes the only place that's his alone. And he feels like his car is his private ship and where no one can come in or tell him what to do there. And I think we all create those little cocoons for ourselves in different ways, those places we feel like we exist alone. And so he spends a lot of time in his car. And I also think that one of the things about city living is so much of life happens in public, where there's so little space inside your apartment that you so much of your life happens on the street or in a local restaurant or in a cafe or in the park. And so sitting in your car also becomes a sort of semi-private space, but also public, where I would watch people every day sitting there reading the paper, eating their breakfast. And life just sort of private life just takes place in public in a different way in a city.
And of course, with a very densely populated city like New York, laws, regulations, social rules are a big part of it. Instead of it being a governmental force in the book, it comes through a neighborly force by the name of Arthur.
Right, Arthur. Oh, he was my favorite. He was actually inspired by a story my sister, who also lives in New York City, told me about a man in her building who she had dubbed Dog Man because she didn't know his name. So she had to refer to him because he had this dog. And I was interested in how people become very proprietary over spaces that you might think are public, and how living among people, there's so many opportunities for friction. When you share a laundry room with people, you have your underwear washing right next to someone else's. And there's this sense that our lives are overlapping and intruding on one another in a way when you don't have a lot of space. And so Arthur, I guess, became the sort of local, sort of individually appointed police force for making sure people behave themselves. And I think with him at first, you know, it was just sort of fun to write about someone who felt entitled to post things and to sort of be the rule keeper, make sure everyone else stayed in line. But then, you know, I feel like, again, my job is always to say, well, what is that about? Why is someone doing this? Why is this man patrolling the lobby? Why is he talking to the doorman all the time? You know, is it about loneliness or desire? What else is going on for this character? And that, I think, is where fiction becomes gratifying to write, where you can create a backstory and a history for someone. And, you know, for Dog Man, I thought about his failed marriage that I created, or about why he has this urge for law and order, what that's about for him.
Nina and Jeremy's lives have been disrupted by their children, and both Leon and Claudia, they have welcomed a child into their home at the beginning of the book, which has disrupted their lives, but it's their adult daughter, Emma.
People talk a lot about, you know, kids who have a failure to launch problem, kids who don't move out of their home, you know, come back home and aren't sure what they want to do with their lives. And in writing about Emma, I was interested in a character who seemingly has it all together, that sense that you finished your parenting job, presumably, right? They go off to college and you're done. And of course, you're never done as a parent. And Emma moves back home with her parents and decides that she doesn't want to continue in the graduate program she's in, and she doesn't really want to get married to the person she's engaged to, and has that urge to push that redo button on her life before she really gets started. And I wanted to think about not just the problem of parenting younger children, but what's harder and in many ways more challenging about parenting older kids. At one point, Leon tells Nina, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems. And wanted to think about how do you find that balance between guidance for kids and giving them independence and letting them make their own mistakes and go down their own wrong paths. And so Emma was a character where I got a chance to think about how we as parents impose our own unfilled longings on our children and how they have to find their own way. And I think about the pain of watching children struggle as well, about parenting through failure, living with an unhappy child and struggling to know what your job is in that moment too.
The book really deals with all these kind of questions about parenting and being a mother and being a father and what's required of one. But can you say something positive? What's the best thing you've done with your kids?
I think part of the best thing is recognizing the multifaceted nature, recognizing that I have birthed these three children who are their own individuals. And that in and of itself is thrilling, that I've birthed not versions of myself, but new separate people with their own internal worlds. And I think watching them become themselves is thrilling. And, you know, I hope the book sort of expresses that sense that it's sort of majestic and mysterious, the notion of how someone becomes themselves. And I think with my kids, it's wanting to find that balance between, you know, loving them, adoring them, and letting them be themselves at the same time. And I think that parenting is this wondrous experience. I mean, I can't think of any experience from which I've grown more or been challenged more or been forced to think about where I begin and end and where someone else begins and ends. And that sense of giving and also letting go. And I think, you know, parenting is a place where we are asked to do that in the most personal and profound way. And also, I think one of the senses that moves me so much as a parent is that there's no one way. There's no one way for a child. There's no one right way for a parent. I think that that earlier notion that if I don't do this for my kids, their lives are ruined. I think we know from experience as we get older that no, it doesn't work that way. Things go in different directions. There's twists and turns and movement forward and steps backward, and that kids move forward from all of those things and that we move forward from them also.
But that uncertainty, ooh, it's tough.
Oh, it is. It's inevitable, right? I mean, the urge for certainty, I know it so well. I think that uncertainty is a very, very hard place to live. I think it's an impossible, inevitable fact of being alive and being human. I think that uncertainty is part of our lives in every way. And I think that the more we accept that, the more we are okay with that fact, that even when we think things are certain, there are things that life always has a way of reminding us that things change. It's the inevitability. But yeah, especially when it's about children, when you love your children and will do anything to protect them, and yet recognize that the limits of parenting also, that sense of things always shift.
I was a political science major, mm-hmm. and it's my pet theory of law that the purpose of law is not for fairness. It's to create a level of predictability mm-hmm. in everyday life mm-hmm. and that you can count on certain things and you don't have to worry that so you can worry about other things.
Right. And yet there are always other things to worry about, right? Nothing can take away the worry of other things.
There's no vacuum when it comes to worry.
No, there's no end to it. And someone sent me an email when my first child was born, how, you know, parenting is like letting your heart walk around outside your body. And that sense, certainly parenting introduces uncertainty. But relationships, right? If you have two people moving through the world and alive as they move through the world and life sort of ricocheting off them in so many ways, you by nature have uncertainty. There's no possible way to seal everyone down and pin them down so that no one can move.
In the book, Jeremy was raised Orthodox. Mm-hmm. And in your books, you've written about Orthodox communities mm-hmm. before. I kind of had a sense with all these kind of strange connections between the characters because they become connected in weird ways that mm-hmm. wouldn't be a typical, oh, we met at a dinner party and now everyone knows each other. It happens much more organically. It kind of reminded me of the, was it Aruv? How do you pronounce that?
Aruv. A boundary around the neighborhood.
Right. In which in some neighborhoods, they connect buildings with wires in order to make an easier space to navigate on the Sabbath. And so we've kind of had this self-contained group of people, and like these connections are the Eruv.
Oh, that's really fascinating. Yeah, an Eruv is a way in Jewish law of kind of, in a sort of theoretical sense, creating a private space out of a public space. So in order to carry, which is prohibited on the Jewish Sabbath, from one space to another, people turn a space into sort of a theoretical private domain where they're allowed to carry items from one space to another. And I think we all create Eruvs or private domains out of public spaces in so many ways. And you know, it's so interesting to think about that idea in this book, because even though my other books are very much about the Orthodox Jewish world, this one is less so and not really about Judaism. But I think about how we – about private and public. And one of the things I was interested in the book is how, on one hand, Manhattan is this vast metropolis where the odds of running into someone you know should be incredibly small statistically. And yet it happens all the time, these sort of serendipitous meetings and chance encounters. And I was interested in how certain neighborhoods in New York seem to take on the logic of small town life. And there was a woman I would see who inspired one of the characters, sort of a woman who seemed to have some psychological issues and was always screaming in the streets. And I would see her every single day. And I was like, how is this possible? But no matter what, I'd be walking my kids to school and there she would be. And I think those moments when we cross people's lives without expecting it, and it was one of the conceits I wanted to play with in the novel, where could you have, how many like lines of connection could you have? How could I play with the notion of probability and predictability and coincidence and sort of tighten the weave on that and say like every character forms different connections to other characters and create this sense that, yes, it's a city and you know what? It's also a real small town at the same time.
And since we're in Memphis, did you know that Elvis was a Shabbos goy?
I did know that, actually, because coincidentally, when I moved to Boston, my next door neighbor happened to be a woman whose father was a cantor in Memphis, I believe, and who lived downstairs from Elvis. And so one of these moments of connection where all of a sudden I'm moving to a new place and someone says, I have a Memphis connection. So, yes, it's interesting.
I think the character in the book that probably is the least sympathetic and we probably know the least is the writer named Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
And as a man named Stephen, I'm a little bit sensitive about that.
Sorry.
But also, he's a fiction writer. And so is this kind of a way of criticizing yourself in the book?
Right. It's funny. Someone said to me, why doesn't Stephen get his own point of view? And originally he did. I think I probably somewhere buried like in the files of Visible City, the 5 million files of unused material is Stephen's point of view. But I was interested in writing about a character who, you know, only seen from his fiance's point of view, who has an arrogance to him, who sort of feels his own sense of grandeur. And I was interested in the way fiction writers maybe sometimes have to seal themselves off from other people in order to create. And I didn't live that kind of life. Maybe I wished I did. I was not living any sort of way where Emma feels like Stephen closes the door and no one's allowed to disturb him. And I feel like maybe that was the prerogative of a male writer. Maybe you can see some of my hostility coming out there that I was not allowed to have. You know, that was just not the way it was going to be for me. I thought about a character who was withholding also. Emma feels like she doesn't have access to him. And one of the ways it manifests itself is that he doesn't want to ever tell her what his book is about. And I think when you're writing a book, it becomes your obsession. And I certainly felt obsessed with Visible City for a long time, this sense that it's hard to see past it. And I think one of the things that I've thought a lot about is how when you're writing a book and so deeply inside of it, is it hard to see the people around you? It's hard to put it down sometimes. And yet that's a hard way to live for a long time also, to feel like I can't see past my fictional world.
I'm sure there were several drafts working through there.
Just 50 or 60.
Is there anything that you're so happy that you left out?
Yeah, it's funny. When I think back to the very, very early versions, I just think, what was I possibly thinking about that? What was I imagining was going to happen? And different characters got written out along the way. Initially, the character of Wendy was three separate mothers. And so Nina had these three friends moving through the book. And someone said to me, I cannot keep them straight. This is too many. And I realized, of course, it was too complicated. And so I felt like I did a surgical procedure to merge the three characters into one character. I think the book just had to go through evolutions. It had to go through so many changes. And some of the characters had to become more marginal, you know, thinking about how to balance so many characters without the book feeling too diffuse and too losing its center. I think at one point I bolstered Nina and said, she is my main character and she's going to be the central narrative push through the novel, even as the other characters are important also. And so the book went through endless, endless drafts, more than anything I've written. And I look at the files on my computer. I think one of the files eventually was called, you know, I'd called it Mommy Novel, was my like little tag name for it, Mommy Novel 55 at some point. And then I stopped numbering. I was like, this is just too depressing, you know, to keep going with the numbers of each draft.
If you would have maybe taken a tack of it not being such a realistic novel and had the three women acting as unison, like as a Greek chorus or something like that.
Right. Well, it's interesting. In The Ladies Auxiliary, my first novel, I told it from a we point of view, the sort of Greek chorus, but I was interested in how people speak in groups and sort of that communal notion of what we're supposed to think versus what we actually think. So, yeah, that could have been, you know, there is that sense also of the Greek chorus of motherhood, of what we're supposed to be like.
Recently, in the New York Times, you published an opinion piece, an essay, about your own divorce. and you're talking about this divide between public and private. Why did you decide to share this personal part of yourself in that way?
Right, I mean, I've been writing some nonfiction essays, and it's definitely different. I mean, in fiction, you, of course, pour parts of yourself into it. You know, I can go through Visible City and underline, and I won't ever do this, won't ever show it to anyone. But that sense of I know where I am in this book. In nonfiction, there's nowhere to hide. It's you. You're putting yourself out in the world. And I do write nonfiction also. I have been writing nonfiction essays over the past few years. And it's a chance to say, well, it's not just me imagining myself into a different character, but here's me. This is my experience in the world. And I think some material works well as fiction, and some material really asks to be nonfiction. I can't imagine having written that essay as a short story. It wasn't a short story. And so I wrote about my divorce and about sort of two leave takings at once from a marriage and also from being part of a certain religious world and about the pain of that and the uncertainty. And I think even though Visible City is not about that, you know, the themes do match for me about change and how we make changes and how what is terrifying and exhilarating about stepping off those edges. And so, you know, writing nonfiction, you know, when it came out in the New York Times, I was very far away. I was in the rainforest of Costa Rica. It just sort of happened that way. And it was sort of a nice place to be far from this feeling that I had put out my most personal knot of pain and uncertainty into the world. And so I'm like, it's not a bad time to be offline. And when I came back to a few hundred emails from strangers that had written to me sort of saying, I relate to your story. I've gone through a divorce, or I've gone through this painful transformation, or I'm also wrestling with religion or belonging or community. And I feel like nonfiction is a way of reaching other people's stories as well. It's a way of saying, I'm not the only one who feels this way. And I think in those moments that are so hard, in our most painful moments, is when it's easier to feel like I'm the only one who feels this way. I'm the only one going through something. And nonfiction writing about our own lives and writing honestly is a way of reminding ourselves and each other that lots of us feel these struggles.
There was a British politician, I can't remember his name right now, but he had just this most wonderful phrase for his election back, I think, in the 70s or 80s. This is my truth. Tell me yours.
I love that. Exactly. Someone said to me recently, very similarly, this is my journey. He's like, you can have a different journey, and my parents have a different journey, and my children will, but this is mine. And I feel that sense so much. So we each have our path and our journey, and people might not like it, and people can be angry, and people can disagree with it or say, you're not telling it the way I experienced it. But all we can each do is tell our story. So this is mine.
And hopefully the trolls weren't too mean to you.
Well, you know, it's funny. I did not read the comments. I decided I cannot handle that. I don't need that. But my closest friend, who's also a novelist, said she was going to read them for me. And so she was sort of monitoring them as they were coming out, as I was far, far away. And they were mostly very nice. And, you know, I was able to hear that there were a few trolls, of course. There always are. But that sense of people feeling connected to the story or feeling like, you know, wishing me well or understanding the way in which that it was written not as an attack on anyone or not as – you know, I'm not interested in saying you're wrong and I'm right. I feel like, what does that even mean? It just feels like saying, this is my experience. This is my grappling with it. This is where I am. And someone might say, well, I believe this. You have to also. And I feel like, but I don't. And you can't make someone else think what you believe. But I don't want to say that you can't believe what you think. It's just saying that, you know, people have different experiences and it's inevitable and unavoidable. And to those who wish for everyone to look the same, you know, it just doesn't. You can argue it all you wish, but it just doesn't.
Talk about this experience relating with people and them sharing their stories back with you. But how do you in the critical world, how do you engage with that?
The critical world. In
terms of the above book criticism.
You know, I try to shield myself as much as I can. I think that there's honest engagement where someone will say, you know, this is what bothers me about your writing, or I think differently. And there you can engage. I feel like you don't have to shield yourself from people who think differently. What I want to shield myself from is the nastiness. And certainly online is when you can write hateful things because no one ever will know it's you. And the way you would never talk to someone in public, of course, or in real life. But it gives us this cover. And there I feel like, what's the point of engaging with just with sort of blatant, open nastiness? But you know, part of putting out a book in the world or an essay is that people have responses. And, you know, for me in writing this essay, or I'm writing a lot of nonfiction now, is being able to say, I've been as thoughtful as I can. I've considered it from all angles. This is my truth. This is mine. And people will respond the way they want, and they'll react based on their experiences and on what they value. And I can't control that. And I think in having a book come out, there's those terrifying feelings of like, you know, reviews and online pieces, and some you can shield yourself from. I told myself I wasn't going to read reviews, but I have been. It's been hard not to. And I think you're kind of in a crouched position when a book comes out. The sort of, you want reviews, you don't want to read them, you want to see them. But feeling ultimately, I think with Visible City, I feel like it's a book I wrote over so many years that I poured all of myself into, and that it's a book that I believe in and stand by. And people can react as they want, but it's my book. This is mine.
I haven't read it. A lot of reviews, but I haven't seen a bad one yet.
I'm very happy that reviews have been really good. It's sort of, you know, I have the negative streak in me of, oh, well, just wait. I'll say they're good, and then tomorrow I'll get slammed. But they have been very good, and it's been really gratifying to read. It was sort of why I decided that I did want to read them. My editor kept sending me reviews, and I was like, okay, I'm going to read these. And it's been really gratifying. I think the best reviews are not the ones that offer the most praise, but when you feel like the reviewer gets it, they understand what I'm doing here, or they understand what this book is about, or they've entered into my vision. And that's when it feels like that the book has made a connection to someone else's world or experience. And those are the ones that have been really meaningful for me to read.
Can we look forward to you maybe gathering your essays in together for a collection?
It's funny. The word memoir is a word I have to pull from my mouth. I'm afraid of the word, but I always like try and say I'm writing a nonfiction personal account of the past few years. But one would call that a memoir, if I can say that word without the discomfort it sparks in me as a novelist. But I'm writing a nonfiction book based on the essay I wrote in the New York Times about grappling with religion and about the end of a marriage, but more so about what does it mean to grow up in a world where there's so much said about what you're supposed to believe and supposed to do and feel like you don't really fit into that, even though you've tried. And I want to think about what you leave behind and what you can maintain, and ask questions about how you teach children about tradition and family, and yet also create for them the possibility of making their own choices and letting them feel a sense of independence and self-reliance, I guess, and being able to determine their own pathway. And so that's what I'm working on now. And writing memoir is, it's daunting. It makes me anxious when I write it for a long time, because what I love about fiction is if it didn't happen that way, well, just change it. You can do whatever you want. There's such freedom in writing fiction. And in nonfiction, I feel an obligation to dig deeper into my own experience and say how I felt it or how I see it. But I can't change what really happened. And that's what's hard about nonfiction.
Well, I hope we get a chance to talk about that one in the future.
Thank you so much.
And thank you again for stopping by and sharing your book with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Tova Mervis is the author of Visible City, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.